Chapter 2. That homely proverb, used on so many occasions in England, viz., that what is bred in the bone will not go out of the flesh, was never more verified than in the story of my life. Anyone would think that after 35 years affliction, and a variety of unhappy circumstances, which few men, if any, ever went through before, and after near 7 years of peace and enjoyment in the fullness of all things, grown old, and when, if ever, it might be allowed me to have had experience of every state of middle life, and to know which was most adapted to make a man completely happy, I say, after all this, anyone would have thought that the native propensity to rambling which I gave an account of in my first setting out in the world, to have been so predominant in my thoughts, should be worn out, and I might, at 61 years of age, have been a little inclined to stay at home, and have done venturing life and fortune any more. Nay, farther, the common motive of foreign adventures was taken away in me, for I had no fortune to make, I had nothing to seek. If I had gained £10,000 I had been no richer, for I had already sufficient for me, and for those I had to leave it to, and what I had was visibly increasing, for, having no great family, I could not spend the income of what I had, unless I would set up for an expensive way of living, such as a great family, servants, equipage, gaiety, and the like, which were things I had no notion of, or inclination to, so that I had nothing, indeed, to do but to sit still, and fully enjoy what I had got, and see it increase daily upon my hands. Yet all these things had no effect upon me, or at least not enough to resist the strong inclination I had to go abroad again, which hung about me like a chronic distemper. In particular, the desire of seeing my new plantation in the island, and the colony I left there, ran in my head continually. I dreamed of it all night, and my imagination ran upon it all day. It was uppermost in all my thoughts, and my fancy worked so steadily and strongly upon it, that I talked of it in my sleep. In short, nothing could remove it out of my mind. It even broke so violently into all my discourses, that it made my conversation tiresome, for I could talk of nothing else. All my discourse ran into it, even to impertinence, and I saw it myself. I have often heard persons of good judgment say that all the stir that people make in the world about ghosts and apparitions is owing to the strength of imagination, and the powerful operation of fancy in their minds, that there is no such thing as a spirit appearing, or a ghost walking, that people's poring affectionately upon the past conversation of their deceased friends so realizes it to them, that they are capable of fancying, upon some extraordinary circumstances, that they see them, talk to them, and are answered by them, when, in truth, there is nothing but shadow and vapor in the thing, and they really know nothing of the matter. For my part, I know not to this hour, whether there are any such things as real apparitions, specters, or walking of people, after they are dead, or whether there is anything in the stories they tell us of that kind more than the product of vapors, sick minds, and wandering fancies. But this I know, that my imagination worked up to such a height, and brought me into such excess of vapors, or what else I may call it, that I actually supposed myself often upon the spot, at my old castle, behind the trees, saw my old Spaniard, Friday's father, and the reprobate sailors I left upon the island. Nay, I fancied I talked with them, and looked at them steadily, though I was broad awake, as at persons just before me. And this I did till I often frightened myself with the images my fancy represented to me. One time, in my sleep, I had the villainy of the three pirate sailors so lively related to me by the first Spaniard, and Friday's father, that it was surprising. They told me how they barbarously attempted to murder all the Spaniards, and that they set fire to the provisions they had laid up, on purpose to distress and starve them. Things that I had never heard of, and that, indeed, were never all of them true in fact. but it was so warm in my imagination, and so realized to me, that, to the hour I saw them, I could not be persuaded, but that it was or would be true. Also how I resented it, when the Spaniard complained to me, and how I brought them to justice, tried them, and ordered them all three to be hanged. What there was really in this shall be seen in its place. For however I came to form such things in my dream, and what secret converse of spirits injected it, yet there was, I say, much of it true. I own that this dream had nothing in it literally and specifically true, but the general part was so true the base, villainous behavior of these three hardened rogues was such, and had been so much worse than all I can describe, that the dream had too much similitude of the fact. And as I would afterwards have punished them severely, so, if I had hanged them all, I had been much in the right, and even should have been justified both by the laws of God and man. But to return to my story. In this kind of temper I lived some years. I had no enjoyment of my life, no pleasant hours, no agreeable diversion, but what had something or other of this in it, so that my wife, who saw my mind wholly bent upon it, told me very seriously one night that she believed there was some secret, powerful impulse of providence upon me, which had determined me to go thither again, and that she found nothing hindered me going, but my being engaged to a wife and children. She told me that it was true she could not think of parting with me. But as she was assured that if she was dead it would be the first thing I would do, so, as it seemed to her that the thing was determined above, she would not be the only obstruction. For, if I thought fit and resolved to go here she found me very intent upon her words, and that I looked very earnestly at her, so that it a little disordered her, and she stopped. I asked her why she did not go on, and say out what she was going to say? But I perceived that her heart was too full, and some tears stood in her eyes. "Speak out, my dear," said I, "are you willing I should go?" "No," says she, very affectionately, "I am far from willing, but if you are resolved to go," says she, "rather than I would be the only hindrance, I will go with you. For though I think it a most preposterous thing for one of your years, and in your condition, yet, if it must be," said she, again weeping, "I would not leave you, for if it be of heaven you must do it, there is no resisting it, and if heaven make it your duty to go, he will also make it mine to go with you, or otherwise dispose of me, that I may not obstruct it." This affectionate behavior of my wife's brought me a little out of the vapors, and I began to consider what I was doing. I corrected my wandering fancy, and began to argue with myself sedately, what business I had after 80 years, and after such a life of tedious sufferings and disasters, and closed in so happy and easy a manner. I say, what business had I to rush into new hazards, and put myself upon adventures fit only for youth and poverty to run into? With those thoughts I considered my new engagement, that I had a wife, one child born, and my wife then great with child of another, that I had all the world could give me, and had no need to seek hazard for gain, that I was declining in years, and ought to think rather of leaving what I had gained than of seeking to increase it, that as to what my wife had said of its being an impulse from heaven, and that it should be my duty to go, I had no notion of that. So, after many of these cogitations, I struggled with the power of my imagination, reasoned myself out of it, as I believe people may always do in like cases if they will. In a word, I conquered it, composed myself with such arguments as occurred to my thoughts, and which my present condition furnished me plentifully with. And particularly, as the most effectual method, I resolved to divert myself with other things, and to engage in some business, that might effectually tie me up from any more excursions of this kind. For I found that thing return upon me, chiefly when I was idle, and had nothing to do, nor anything of moment immediately before me. To this purpose, I bought a little farm in the county of Bedford, and resolved to remove myself thither. I had a little convenient house upon it, and the land about it, I found, was capable of great improvement, and it was many ways suited to my inclination, which delighted in cultivating, managing, planting, and improving of land, and particularly, being an inland country, I was removed from conversing among sailors and things relating to the remote parts of the world. I went down to my farm, settled my family, bought plows, harrows, a cart, wagon horses, cows, and sheep, and, setting seriously to work, became in one half year a mere country gentleman. My thoughts were entirely taken up in managing my servants, cultivating the ground, enclosing, planting, and and I lived, as I thought, the most agreeable life that nature was capable of directing, or that a man always bred to misfortunes, was capable of retreating to. I farmed upon my own land. I had no rent to pay, was limited by no articles. I could pull up or cut down as I pleased. What I planted was for myself, and what I improved was for my family, and having thus left off the thoughts of wandering, I had not the least discomfort in any part of life, as to this world. Now I thought, indeed, that I enjoyed the middle state of life which my father so earnestly recommended to me, and lived a kind of heavenly life, something like what is described by the poet, upon the subject of a country life. Free from vices, free from care, age has no pain, and youth no snare. But in the middle of all this felicity, one blow from unseen providence unhinged me at once, and not only made a breach upon me inevitable and incurable, but drove me, by its consequences, into a deep relapse of the wandering disposition, which, as I may say, being born in my very blood, soon recovered its hold of me, and, like the returns of a violent distemper, came on with an irresistible force upon me. This blow was the loss of my wife. It is not my business here to write an elegy upon my wife, give a character of her particular virtues, and make my court to the sex by the flattery of a funeral sermon. She was, in a few words, the stay of all my affairs, the center of all my enterprises, the engine that, by her prudence, reduced me to that happy compass I was in, from the most extravagant and ruinous project that filled my head, and did more to guide my rambling genius than a mother's tears, a father's instructions, a friend's counsel, or all my own reasoning powers could do. I was happy in listening to her, and in being moved by her entreaties, and to the last degree desolate and dislocated in the world by the loss of her. When she was gone, the world looked awkwardly round me. I was as much a stranger in it, in my thoughts, as I was in the Brazils, when I first went on shore there, and as much alone, except for the assistance of servants, as I was in my island. I knew neither what to think nor what to do. I saw the world busy around me. One part laboring for bread, another part squandering in vile excesses or empty pleasures, but equally miserable, because the end they proposed still fled from them. For the men of pleasure every day surfeited of their vice, and heaped up work for sorrow and repentance, and the men of labor spent their strength in daily struggling for bread, to maintain the vital strength they labored with. So living in a daily circulation of sorrow, living but to work, and working but to live, as if daily bread were the only end of wearisome life, and a wearisome life the only occasion of daily bread. This put me in mind of the life I lived in my kingdom, the island, where I suffered no more corn to grow, because I did not want it, and bred no more goats, because I had no more use for them, where the money lay in the drawer till it grew moldy, and had scarce the favor to be looked upon in 20 years. All these things, had I improved them as I ought to have done, and as reason and religion had dictated to me, would have taught me to search farther than human enjoyments for a full felicity, and that there was something which certainly was the reason and end of life superior to all these things, and which was either to be possessed, or at least hoped for, on this side of the grave. But my sage counselor was gone. I was like a ship without a pilot, that could only run afore the wind. My thoughts ran all away again into the old affair, My head was quite turned with the whimsies of foreign adventures, and all the pleasant, innocent amusements of my farm, my garden, my cattle, and my family, which before entirely possessed me, were nothing to me, had no relish, and were like music to one that has no ear, or food to one that has no taste. In a word, I resolved to leave off housekeeping, let my farm, and return to London, and in a few months after I did so. When I came to London, I was still as uneasy as I was before. I had no relish for the place, no employment in it, nothing to do but to saunter about like an idle person, of whom it may be said he is perfectly useless in God's creation, and it is not one farthing's matter to the rest of his kind, whether he be dead or alive. This also was the thing which, of all circumstances of life, was the most my aversion, who had been all my days used to an active life, and I would often say to myself, a state of idleness is the very dregs of life, and, indeed, I thought I was much more suitably employed when I was 26 days making a deal board. It was now the beginning of the year 1693 when my nephew, whom, as I have observed before, I had brought up to the sea, and had made him commander of a ship, was come home from a short voyage to Bilbao, being the first he had made. He came to me, and told me that some merchants of his acquaintance had been proposing to him to go a voyage for them to the East Indies, and to China, as private traders. And now, uncle, says he, if you will go to sea with me, I will engage to land you upon your old habitation in the island, for we are to touch at the Brazils. Nothing can be a greater demonstration of a future state, and of the existence of an invisible world, than the concurrence of second causes with the idea of things which we form in our minds, perfectly reserved, and not communicated to any in the world. My nephew knew nothing how far my distemper of wandering was returned upon me, and I knew nothing of what he had in his thought to say, when that very morning, before he came to me, I had, in a great deal of confusion of thought, and revolving every part of my circumstances in my mind, come to this resolution, that I would go to Lisbon, and consult with my old sea captain. And if it was rational and practicable, I would go and see the island again, and what was become of my people there. I had pleased myself with the thoughts of peopling the place, and carrying inhabitants from hence, getting a patent for the possession and I know not what, when, in the middle of all this, in comes my nephew, as I have said, with his project of carrying me thither in his way to the East Indies. I paused a while at his words, and looking steadily at him, "What devil," said I, "sent you on this unlucky errand?" My nephew stared, as if he had been frightened at first, but perceiving that I was not much displeased at the proposal, he recovered himself. "I hope it may not be an unlucky proposal, sir," says he. "I dare say you would be pleased to see your new colony there, where you once reigned with more felicity than most of your brother monarchs in the world. In a word, the scheme hit so exactly with my temper, that is to say, the prepossession I was under, and of which I have said so much, that I told him, in a few words, if he agreed with the merchants, I would go with him, but I told him I would not promise to go any further than my own island. Why, sir, says he, you don't want to be left there again, I hope. But, said I, can you not take me up again on your return? He told me it would not be possible to do so, that the merchants would never allow him to come that way with a laden ship of such value, it being a month's sail out of his way, and might be three or four. Besides, sir, if I should miscarry, said he, and not return at all, then you would be just reduced to the condition you were in before. This was very rational, but we both found out a remedy for it, which was to carry a frame sloop on board the ship, which, being taken in pieces, might, by the help of some carpenters, whom we agreed to carry with us, be set up again in the island, and finished fit to go to sea in a few days. I was not long resolving, for indeed the importunities of my nephew joined so effectually with my inclination, that nothing could oppose me. On the other hand, My wife being dead, none concern themselves so much for me as to persuade me one way or the other, except my ancient good friend the widow, who earnestly struggled with me to consider my years, my easy circumstances, and the needless hazards of a long voyage, and above all, my young children. But it was all to no. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.